Hello, this is your Sun Sounds volunteer reader, Michael Lee, and Flagstaff with the Prescott Daily Courier. Today I'll be reading articles dated November 24th, 2024. Some of today's headlines are: Helicopter pad approved for exceptional healthcare hospital along Highway 69. Charlotte Hall Museum's Snaps and Clasps exhibit showcases how fashion shaped local history. And $2.5 million renovation expansion contract approved for County Community Health Services. Our first article, Helicopter Pad Approved for Exceptional Healthcare Hospital Along Highway 69, by Cindy Barks. A helicopter landing pad requested for a new emergency-based hospital along Highway 69 received approval by the Prescott Board of Adjustment last week, despite concerns that the pad should have been part of the consideration when the project went through the city's initial site plan considerations. In a 5-1 vote on Thursday, November 21st, the Board of Adjustment approved a conditional use permit for a helipad at the new Exceptional Healthcare Hospital that is under construction at 4822 East Highway 69, near the Diamond Valley community between Prescott and Prescott Valley. The hospital parcel is within Prescott city limits, and community planner Tammy DeWitt told the board that the project had earlier gone through the city's formal site plan review process and had received a water allocation from the Prescott City Council. But, in response to the questions from the board about the timing of the helipad conditional use permit, DeWitt said, the pad, was never discussed. We never knew there was going to be a proposed helipad here when we started the initial discussions with them. She added that the parcel's business regional zoning allowed for the hospital use. The helipad, because it's considered a helistop, no helicopter based at the site and no fueling. DeWitt said, we do allow these with conditional use permit in the business regional zoning district. Had the community development department known about the helistop proposal in the beginning, DeWitt said, we would have had them go through this process when we did the site plan review. Since we found out about it, they have been working with staff to get through this to allow for it. Board member Thomas Davis said he was a little frustrated by the process, maintaining that the helistop should have been contemplated when the original development went through the city council. It should have been included at that time. A nearby resident also brought up the timing of the permit. It feels to me that they're doing it anyway, and then asking for forgiveness later. Area property owner Jeanette Westmoreland told the board, that's just not fair to us. Westmoreland and several other residents maintain that having the helicopter pad so close to their homes, and in some cases their vacation rental properties, would have negative impact on their quality of life and their rental income. If this helicopter landing pad was proposed for your neighborhood, how would you respond? Longtime Diamond Valley resident Barry Golden asked the board. Is it really necessary? Do we really need one there? A number of representatives from the Exceptional Healthcare maintained that the helistop was needed to ensure proper medical care for the emergencies that the hospital would be dealing with. Dr. Bruce McVeigh, the chief operating officer and one of the primary owners of Exceptional Healthcare, told the board, Exceptional is based on an emergency medicine-based hospital. The facility is licensed through the state of Arizona as a general hospital with an emergency-based core, McVeigh said, adding that the hospital would have had an emergency room with 10 emergency beds and an inpatient side with 8 beds. Responding to questions from the board about the frequency and schedule of the helicopter traffic, McVeigh said Exceptional Healthcare's other Arizona hospitals in Maricopa, Eloy, and Bullhead City average about one helicopter transfer per week. He said most of the traffic would involve transporting a patient out to other hospitals in the Phoenix area rather than transporting patients in. We'll have transfer agreements with all the hospitals in the area, McVeigh said. Where the patients are transported to will depend on what the patient is presenting with. It all comes down to the physician, of where we would send, and where would that patient needs to go. In response to questions from the board about whether helicopter could land without the pad, McVeigh added, if it means saving a patient's life, we'll put that helicopter where it needs to go. Dr. Paul Gilbert, the medical director for the hospital, added there would be a number of scenarios in which a patient might be transferred out, including emergencies such as an aneurysm or brain bleed. Without the option of transport by helicopter, he said, the hospital likely would use an ambulance to transport to Phoenix, which would be a significant delay, or an ambulance to get the patient to the nearest helicopter landing pad in the Prescott area. Noting that patients being transported would be unstable, Gilbert said, being able to wheel them to the helicopter has some benefit, rather than having to get somewhere close via ambulance. That's an added step. Board Chairman Jim Lamerson asked about the other nearby helipad sites that might be used by the hospital without putting it in the middle of a residential area. He added, I don't necessarily think the helicopter pad is a necessity. You're going to land that helicopter where you need to land it to save a life. Concerns also arose about the proximity of the landing pad to Highway 69, which some board members said could be a distraction to passing traffic. But the majority of the board members appeared to agree that the helicopter landing pad was warranted to allow the hospital to provide the best care to patients. Board member Tom Hutchinson emphasized the golden hour, the first hour after which prompt medical care is most likely to improve a patient's outcome. It seems to me the whole idea of an emergency facility is to stabilize the person and get them to the definitive care place they need to be and fast. Hutchinson said, otherwise, it's a 2 or 3 hour ride and basically the patient dies. After a motion to approve the conditional use permit with no conditions failed in a 4-2 vote, the board made a second motion, ultimately approving the permit with conditions, including a screening masonry wall on the north and west property lines and additional landscaping along Highway 69 frontage adjacent to the helipad. The second motion was approved in a 5-1 vote, with Lamerson voting against it. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then click on Demand. Our next article, Charlotte Hall Museum's Snaps and Clasps exhibit, showcases how fashion shaped local history, by Nancy Hudson. Ever wonder what it might be like to carry an alligator skin clutch purse dating back to 1941, embellished with a tiny alligator face and feet on the front? Or how about attending a gala opening in an eye-catching 1965 pink wool coat with a muskrat firm trim, accessorized with a 1925 black prickly pear hat? Maybe, maybe not. In the new Charlotte Hall Museum's Snaps and Clasps Fashion from the Collection exhibit at the Center Gallery in front of the Lawler Building, these featured iconic fashion styles and accessories dating from the 1870s to the 1970s are on display for locals and visitors of all ages and genders to see up close. All are part of a 4,500-piece fashion collection with major samples to be selected and rotated through the gallery between now and July. More than 100 people attended the exhibit opening celebration on November 1st, with the exhibit open to the public on November 2nd. With simplicity in mind, the museum's curator of collections and exhibits, Jackson Metal, said the goal with this 2-year research venture is to offer all comers a glimpse into Prescott's history rooted in the clothing, shoes, pocketbooks, hats, and jewelry that speak to the fashion trends of the era. In the panels Metal prepared to accompany the various pieces, including a closet of living history, clothes that exhibit visitors can model in a nearby mirror for selfies or just take an imaginary trip back in time, he declares that clothing styles are far more than just pieces of cotton, wool, silk, or satin. They speak to the identity of the wearer. Think military uniforms, formal wear, or the evolution of business suits for men and women. One of Metal's favorite pieces now on display is a century-old, multicolored, crazy quilt embroidered gown that he paired next to a modest yet elegant lavender gown someone in the 1900s to 1920s might have worn to a wedding or a high tea. Clothing has many uses, from the functional element to a marker of status, an identification with a group, or even a way to rebel, Mendel wrote on an opening panel. Our clothing speaks to who we are as much as who we are not. As a folklore enthusiast, Mendel said he is impressed with the museum's collection that offers a wide range of attire that invites the viewer to recognize how people of different periods use clothing to fashion themselves. In our own tour of the exhibit, Charlotte Hall marketing coordinator Amy Garbo said that she enjoyed most seeing the Prescott connection to the fashion I had no idea existed. One of the displays shows a catalog for the Thunderbird Fashion House before it went out of business in the 1960s, was the Frontier Territorial Capital's third largest employer, she noted. For museum members or visitors with a one-day admission ticket, $12 for adults, $10 for seniors and active duty military or veterans, $6 for college students, or $5 for youth 12 to 17, the exhibit can be toured in under an hour, or they can invest more time in a variety of interactive activities, including creating adult paper dolls. One particularly unique feature in this exhibit is a nod to the creative fashion talents of one at Charlotte Hall's own, Melissa Polaris, the museum's gift store and admissions supervisor since February. In a corner beyond the main stage area, the Arizona State University graduate with a degree in fashion design was tapped to build a gown over the course of the exhibit. She crafted a muslin-designed sketch taped above the dress mannequin, now sports a hint of the gown to come, a shimmery, earth-toned striped satin taffeta material with dark brown and corset-style under bodice. The outer shell facing will be made of an iridescent chiffon with black tulle netting under the underlayer. Just fabulous, Polaris said of this timeless exhibit that is offering her a golden opportunity to showcase her fashion design sense and seamstress skills she intends to transform into her own Prescott tailoring business this year. Once she finds the ideal location, Polaris said she will name her shop Zach Morris, a reference to a childhood nickname by a favorite uncle. As fashion and museum exhibit appreciator, Polaris said she is awed by the meticulous selection of pieces that tell a story of time, place, and people. She is particularly intrigued by the 1960s. She noted the bottom fabric of her gown in progress is of that very vintage. I feel like this exhibit will appeal to everyone, Polaris said of the mix of elegant dresses and a 1925 tuxedo that would be suitable to wear today to the eclectic array of jewelry and handbags. As for her part in it all, Polaris said she is simply delighted to have been asked to contribute and is eager to have repeat customers witness the progression and final product she completes. It's a huge step forward for me, Polaris said. This installation solidifies who I am as a designer, and it validates the work I do is meaningful. One of the final panels, Mendel spelled out the why behind the offerings of this exhibit, and he invites all to come and experience it for themselves. Clothing and dress is a unique space where industry and art collide, where he bespoke sits along the utilitarian. Our choices in each of these directions show the people around us who we are and what we value. Clothing does more than you might think. You're tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you're listening to the Prescott Daily Courier. Our next article, $2.5 million renovation expansion contract approved for the County Community Health Services, by Cindy Barks. After searching unsuccessfully for a new location for the Yavapai County Community Health Center, the Community Health Services Department is opting to renovate and expand its existing facility on Commerce Drive. In a unanimous vote on Wednesday, November 20th, the Yavapai County Board of Supervisors approved a $2.5 million contract with C.G. Schmidt Incorporated to renovate and expand the County Community Health Services Department building at 1090 Commerce Drive. Community Health Services Director Leslie Horton told the supervisors, "As you recall, a couple of years ago, we were looking for a completely separate building for public health. But," she said, "fortunately, I believe, none of those sites worked out for us. We even put in a couple of offers, and we knew that the buildings we were looking at had a lot of work that they would need. Ultimately, Horton said the department chose to maintain its entire operation at the building it has occupied for the past 20 years, located off Commerce Drive. It's a good location for us, and one of the things that makes it good is that our patients, our public, know where we're located, Horton said. She added that the project would also allow the entire department to remain under one roof, which, she said, is the best model for us. The renovation project will involve an expansion component, which Horton said would help to provide better experience for patients at the center, and would also provide more space for employees. We need new space, she said, noting that the department had experienced tremendous growth in the 20 years it's been in the building. We have far more staff than we had. We've used up every closet, every nook and cranny, she said. Along with 24 additional staffing spaces, the project will provide a larger, more open and convenient lobby for patients. In response to a question from Supervisor Harry Oberg about whether the expansion would accommodate future growth, Horton said growth was taken into consideration, and this does account for the next 20 years very well. Yavapai County Facilities Director Brandon Schultz led off the discussion by noting that the project was fully compliant ARPA, the American Rescue Act Plan project, which was bid using federal and ARPA requirements. The project is being funded through a $2.5 million of ARPA money, he added. That prompted Board Chairman Craig Brown to ask whether the project would use any county money in addition to the federal ARPA money. Is there any general fund money being used for this project? Brown asked. It's very important to me and my vote that we don't use general fund money for this project. Horton responded that no general fund money is being planned for the project, although she said the department could seek other grants to help with the costs if needed. But, she said, C.G. Schmidt bid us a bid that they could do this project within budget. They met the budget mark, but they also met all of the needs that we were asking for. Schultz explained that the project would differ from the county's usual design bid build projects in that it would be a design build project that would have the design work done in conjunction with the builder. It should improve quality control, it should improve ultimate features, and it should make a better experience for us as an owner to make sure we're getting what we need and the health department is getting all of the features they need, Schultz said of the design build format. Nicole Schneider of C.G. Schmidt told the supervisors, when we first walked the space, we immediately identified where there were better ways to serve the community, she added. When we go through the design build process, we're designing within budget and we're maximizing the dollars that you have. Under ARPA regulations, projects funded through the Act must be under contract by the end of 2024 and completed by the end of 2026. The county's contract with C.G. Schmidt states that the term of the contract would run from November 20th, 2024 to December 31st, 2026. You can get our stream and on-demand programs with our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Prescott's First Holiday Light Parade by Kristen Kaufman. Albuquerque calls it their Twinkle Light Parade. Sacramento calls it the Holiday Parade of Lights. St. George has a Christmas Light Parade, and Tacoma has an Electric Light Parade. Many cities all over the country have Christmas parades at night, including the APS Electric Light Parade, held in Phoenix every year since the late 1980s. In 1996, the Prescott Chamber of Commerce decided that Prescott should have a light parade as well. The Daily Courier newspaper announced the first event, explaining, "Downtown lights will be darkened on November 30th as the first annual Electric Light Parade moves around the Courthouse Plaza to kick off this year's holiday season in Prescott. Unlike a usual parade, an Electric Light Parade is held at night, and floats are decorated with lights. A workshop, which is open to anyone interested in the parade, will be held at Fire Station 72. Diane Douche, owner of the company called Festive Fantasy in Phoenix, will speak and offer instruction on how to build an electric light float. Awards will be given for floats in various categories. Pre-parade activities will include carolers, and nonprofit organizations will sell refreshments. Today, when you attend the light parade downtown, there will be music playing and there may still be nonprofit organizations selling hot drinks. Another common feature of the event are vendors selling glow sticks of various kinds. For the first light parade, Prescott City Council advertised for performers for a pre-show. Prescott Holiday Light Parade, planned for November 30th, is looking for small groups of street performers, all of all ages, to entertain around the Courthouse Plaza before the parade starts. Groups of carolers, instrumentalists, puppeteers, and clowns are being recruited. The Light Parade was originally under the auspice of the Chamber of Commerce when it began in 1996. Since the Prescott Downtown Partnership was established in 1999, they have taken stewardship over the Light Parade and the Bonfire Festival. According to Flagstaff's Daily Sun, November 27, 1996, organizers of the first parade encouraged entries from all over Arizona to participate. The inaugural light parade had 30 parade entries, and the number of entries has since then has not exceeded 40. As part of the parade entry requirements, no float is permitted to feature Santa Claus, as the sponsored Santa, this year sponsored by APS, is the last float and the star of the show. Unlike many other parade traditions in Prescott, horses are not allowed for the evening parades, and parade entries are encouraged to cover their floats with at least 60% lights. To garner interest in the first parade, the Daily Courier highlighted short articles or cut lines of several entries leading up to the event, which included a photo band of teacher Paul Mance at Granite Mountain Middle School, proudly displaying lights donated by Landrew Development, and a shot of Greg Nordyke from the Prescott Police Department decorating a 100-year-old sleigh. The day before the parade, the Daily Courier also featured a photo of firefighters Alan Snyder and Tony Reed standing on a fire department ladder to hang strings of Christmas lights on a tree outside City Hall in preparation for the event. Initially in 1996, there was no bonfire festival afterwards. In 2016, the Prescott Downtown Partnership started offering a bonfire on the field of Mile High Middle School. Now that the after-party is part of the parade, all judging takes place while the parade floats are parked and while onlookers view them. Roast some s'mores by the bonfire and listen to Christmas music. Prescott's own holiday light parade tradition continues this year, taking place Saturday, November 30th, beginning at 6 p.m. You can hear sun sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Just ask the device to open Sun Sounds of Arizona. Our last article, Prescott Public Library Corner, Squirreling Away Books for Winter, by Paula Fortier. This week I shared a cartoon on my social media page. The image shows a squirrel walking along a tree branch with his arms full of books, heading to his nest already overflowing with all variety of books. This crisp, blustery weather has me in book squirrel mode. I'm constantly putting holds on items in the library and in my Libby app, as well as popping into the Friends book sale in the library watching for books that catch my eye. Believe me when I tell you that I'm one of their best customers. I like nothing better than curling up with a new book and staying out of the cold. If you have similar yearnings, the library is the place for you. December is Read a New Book Month, which seems appropriate. However, if I don't keep a list of books, I often pick up a title that 10 to 20 pages in, I realize I've already read. Unless it's an exceptionally good read, then I decide to reread it. I am disappointed that I squirreled away that title and took up my time and space with it. This is especially annoying if I've put a title on hold, either physically or on my Libby app for an audiobook. To minimize this frustration, I use a variety of tools to help me keep track of the books I've read and the books I can't wait to read. To track the books I've already read, I utilize the library's opt-in system in my online account to track my reading history. You can do this just by logging into your account, then selecting Reading History on the left menu, and choose Start Recording My Reading History. From this point forward, you'll see everything you've checked out. Libby keeps track of any ebooks or e-audiobooks I check out as well. To see this, I just click on the smart tag Borrowed, and then I scroll through everything I've read or listened to. I've also created a smart tag for my want to read list. Just today, a patron asked me how many items I have on my want to read list, and I was a bit dismayed to see I was up to 419. So many books, so little time, indeed. If you need any help setting up Libby on your phone or device, you can book a librarian or just use our drop-in tech help on Tuesday mornings. Goodreads is another tool I use to track books I've read. What I really like about Goodreads is that I can create subject tags for each book. That way I can search my list for the mystery book about search and rescue dogs set in Georgia, and up will pop one of my favorite mystery series so I can share with people as we chat about books. Virginia Lanier is the author, since someone out there will ask. How do I learn about all these books that I want to read? One way is by signing up for the awesome Next Reads newsletter that are available through the Prescott Public Library. You can choose any or all 20 different interests and receive monthly lists of newly released books. Just go to our website and choose the tab for books, movies, and more, then click Beyond the Catalog and click on Next Reads link to fill out the new form for your newsletter choices. As I also regularly browse the library's the new book section in adult, teen, and children's areas, since I regularly read items from all of these areas. And, of course, I'm always talking about books and asking about people's favorites or latest reads. I hope you and your inner book squirrel find some of these hints helpful. Enjoy your latest new read. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader, Michael Lee, and this was the Prescott Daily Courier. Thanks for listening.